This is a session entitled, I can't even remember what the title is, but it's something about, is peace possible with a question mark? And maybe we'll have some idea at the end of an hour whether it might be possible or not. The situation's certainly getting interesting. The one thing about watching the Israeli-Palestinian situation is that it may be stagnant, or not stagnant, but things may not happen, but then something will happen and it will change everything, and that's exactly, in a sense, what's happened the last week, so I want to tell you a little bit about that. Well, one of the first questions that people ask when we talk about this issue is, what exactly do the Palestinians want? And one of the people who I interviewed back in the summer of 1985 for this book, Unified in Hope, is a young Palestinian Christian from a rather well-known family in Jerusalem, whose name is Dawood Kutab. He is a journalist. And when I asked him a question about his dreams, what he dreamt, this is what he said. "I don't have specific dreams, I have general dreams. I dream of being able to drive to Nazareth and continue on to Beirut. I would like to go and see my uncle's family in Amman without it being a historical experience that I wait months to prepare for. If you're a Palestinian, you cross the bridge to go into Amman. It's a very long, complicated process, and it probably takes you about a day to get through all the security to get to Jordan. I would like to get up in the morning and participate mainly, maybe only in a small way, in the decisions that our leaders are making. It would be nice, when I complain about the holes in my street, to have the person at the municipality speak to me on the phone in Arabic, not Hebrew. I would like to go myself to the city hall and find out who is responsible for the holes in the street and the lights not working. I want to be involved, and I want to know that we have a choice, that we have a role in our future. The Israelis make choices. I would like to be able to vote in elections every now and then. I would like to be involved in criticizing the new Palestinian state if it is not doing something about women's rights or when the workers are being unfairly treated and so on. I don't want to spend the rest of my life complaining about the Israelis. That is not my future. I want to be involved in building my own future rather than trying to destroy Israel's future in the hope that somehow that will help me build mine. After all this destruction, we would have to begin all over again, and I don't want to begin again. I just don't want to be involved in any destruction. I would be happy if the Israelis would withdraw peacefully, but unfortunately, I see this happening only if they are pressured to do so. If there is another war, then directly or indirectly, I'm involved in this cycle of destruction. I don't want this to happen. I want to be involved in building rather than destroying." Granted, Dawood Kutab is a rather special person. He's a very moderate Palestinian. But I believe he is beginning to represent a larger and larger community within the Palestinian group. I interviewed that same summer the mayor of Bethlehem, another Christian by the name of Elias Frege, and he talked about this situation as one where you have two sides. In the past, he said, it was the Palestinians. We were the ones who were most rejectionist. We were the ones who didn't want to make compromises. And now what you see is, certainly since 1967 and even after that, probably beginning 8 years ago, Palestinians began to be much more realistic in the way they looked at the situation. And unfortunately, the Israelis tended to be much more unrealistic. So he said you have a situation where somewhere along the line in the last 5 to 10 years, especially since 1977 when the Likud government, the Likud is the party of the conservatives, the party of Prime Minister Shamir today, the party that wants no territorial compromise. The Likud was first elected to power in 1977, and it was about that time that the two trains kind of passed each other. And that is it's a very unfortunate situation, and I want to talk about a little more about that later, how it affects the current political situation. The Palestinians had talked about what they called a secular democratic state. Some years ago, certainly after 48, and they even talked about this after 1967, that they wanted this secular democratic state. They talked about what they called a secular democratic state, meaning that this would be a state where Palestinians and Israelis would live together. It wouldn't be a Jewish state, and that obviously the Jews would be a minority, but they would be a protected minority. Well, considering Jewish history, you can understand why that idea just didn't really fly very well. And unfortunately, the Palestinians stuck to that idea long after a lot of people had been counseling them that this was just a non-starter and that perhaps they had better drop that idea and start dealing with the fact that the Israelis existed and that the state of Israel existed, and it did not look as though it was going to go away. I think one thing that's kind of interesting to look at this point is some of the history of the development of the nationalist movement among the Palestinians, which we all know as the Palestine Liberation Organization, and to look a little bit at that their leader, the chairman of that organization, Yasser Arafat. Palestinian students really set up a group which is the mainline group in the PLO. The PLO is made up of a number of different organizations that again span the spectrum from conservative to liberal. From the Fatah is the main organization. It is the largest group within the PLO, and it is the most moderate, and it's the one that Arafat represents more than any of the others. There are certainly splinter groups to the right of that organization, but Fatah so far is the largest. Yasser Arafat may not have been the leader of that organization when it first began, but he certainly became the principal spokesperson and then years later became the chairman of the PLO. Arafat is a very interesting person. He was born, people are not really sure, but they think around 1928. They think that some people say he was born in Jerusalem, some say he was born in Gaza, some say he was born in Cairo. We do know that he was brought up in Gaza, and that he comes from a very well-to-do family, a family that has a lot of political connections. His mother was a member of the Husseini family, which to this day is a very well-known family in Jerusalem. His father was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, so that gives you some idea that there was a kind of a nationalistic, politically active family from the beginning.
His father was a Jew?
No, his father was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Oh.
Arafat is a Muslim himself, though he is certainly not a terribly dedicated Muslim in the sense that the people he has around him and the leadership of the PLO are people who are not particularly devout. The Fatah organization is a very secular and it's interesting. I'll read a little bit from this book to give you some idea of that organization and how Arafat needed it to be Islamic enough so that it could garner support from some of the more conservative Islamic states in the area, but it also could garner support from some of the more secular states. It says, Fatah, the political and ultimately paramilitary group founded by Arafat and his associates, was marked from the beginning by a shrewd, pragmatic political intelligence. There's one thing you can say about Arafat. This man certainly is not does not have blood in his hands. He is not any kind of, I don't mean to paint his picture as any great great hero. He is a leader of a national liberation movement, and most leaders of national liberation movements have had to do things that they're not particularly proud of and have had blood on their hands. The same way with the Israelis. This is not an issue of black and white. There's a lot of grays here. Confining itself to one purpose only, the liberation of Palestine, Fatah aimed at eventually securing support and funding from as much as possible of the Arab world. Its very name and the name of Arafat carried a message of quiet reassurance to Saudi Arabia and the principalities of the Gulf. Saudi Arabia and the principalities of the Gulf, of course, are very conservative Islamic states. Fatah means in Arabic literally opening, but it has a specific Islamic connotation. It has come to mean opening by conquest of a land for Islam. So there you have the kind of specifically Islamic tinge to it an organization that could be accepted by the more conservative states in the area. The name Fatah implied that this group was not interested in westernizing, secularizing, or spreading Marxist ideas. In short, that it contained nothing incompatible with Orthodox Islam. At the same time, Fatah, having touched the Muslim world, or Muslim note subliminally, left it at that. There was no Muslim fundamentalist appeals, as with the with some of the other parties. Fatah wanted to close no important Arab doors. It wanted to attract the support of the secular modernizing Arab states, specifically Egypt and Syria, as well as the Orthodox and oil-rich ones. Fatah was Muslim, but not too Muslim, which was about right for the region and the time. Arafat has always been, in a way, castigated for not being more forthcoming, not being able to make more clear-cut decisions. The Israelis have always wanted to paint him as indecisive and unable to make the right kind of decisions at the right time. But what you have to understand is that Arafat was constantly doing a balancing act. He was doing a balancing act between all the factions within the PLO. He couldn't go too far to the left because then he would alienate one political faction. He couldn't go too far to the right or he would alienate another one. And since the PLO, really for the Palestinians, was the only political game in town, he had to be very careful about what he did. And of course, in a sense, it tied his hands. He also had to play off one Arab country against the other. He needed the support from Saudi Arabia. He needed support from Egypt, from everywhere he could get it. And therefore, he had to do the same kind of balancing act. And that is not an easy thing, considering the rivalries that have gone on with the Arab world. You know, Syria and Egypt are at odds, or Jordan and Egypt are at odds, or the Saudis are at odds with somebody. So trying to get the support he needed for his movement was a real balancing act, and he's a real professional at it. This, of course, made him, I think, unable to make some decisions that he would have liked to have made. From what I read now, coming from Arafat, I realize that he is a very practical, pragmatic person, and probably would have liked to have made the speech that he made, the speech he made in Geneva at the United Nations in December and the press conference afterward, where he accepted UN Resolution 242 and 338, recognized Israel's right to exist, and renounced terrorism. I think he probably would have liked to have made that speech sometime earlier. But again, the time was not right within his own organization. Playing to these militant factions within the PLO sometimes made it difficult for him to respond to a growing understanding that Israel was there to stay. I think Arafat, along within the last 4 or 5 years, has been much more pragmatic and much more realistic than his rhetoric, but his rhetoric was necessary for the factions within the PLO, in order to keep the PLO together. There's an interesting story about a man by the name of Abu Iyad, who, before he joined Arafat and the Fatah organization, had been associated with another more militant faction of the PLO, which is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a man by the name of George Habash. And Abu Iyad had been with Habash and was with him in Beirut during the Israeli invasion, when we saw television screens, all the bombs falling on Beirut. Habash has been always much more rejectionist than Arafat, has always wanted to fight the military option with Israel, never recognize Israel's right to exist, etc. And Abu Iyad talks about being with Habash in a basement in Beirut as all the bombs were falling down and huge explosions all around, and kind of pointing up to the ceiling and looking at Habash and saying, see, they do exist. He says that it was that experience in Beirut that led him to leave the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and join Arafat, and now he is one of Arafat's closest advisors. The main problem, as I said, for Arafat is that he constantly had to do this balancing act among factions within the PLO and among Arab governments. And he also had a problem with being a leader at a distance. It's very hard to lead any kind of national liberation movement when you cannot be on the ground with the people that you're trying to lead. And of course, he was in Lebanon until the PLO was kicked out of Lebanon. They went to Tunis. I've often wondered how good people like Desmond Tutu and some of the other leaders in South Africa would do if they had to be in exile, if they could not be in South Africa with the people. It's a very, very difficult kind of thing to have to lead a liberation movement when you have to be outside the country. In one of the reasons, of course, Arafat couldn't be in the West Bank, and why it's been very difficult for any official leadership of the Palestinian community to arise, is that as soon as that happens, and they, as they would certainly do, say that they are associated with the PLO, the Israelis would immediately deport them. And since the uprising has begun, the Israelis have deported about 55 people. In 1976, the Israelis allowed municipal elections in the West Bank, and out of about 116 people who were elected to offices, 96 of them said that they supported the PLO. And many of them were then deported. They were mayors of some of the major West Bank towns. They had, in a couple cases, their legs blown off. Car bombs were planted, that kind of thing. So this is why there has been really no chance for official PLO leadership to be on the ground in the West Bank. Palestinian frustration, and certainly the Palestinians were from time to time very frustrated with the PLO, that's for sure. They didn't see anything moving. Nothing happening, and I think their frustration really came to a head in the fall of 1987, when there was a major Arab meeting which simply overlooked the whole Palestinian question and were much more involved at that point with the Iran-Iraq war. At that time, we heard the PLO was finished, we heard that Arafat was finished, but it's always amazing. We've heard that about Arafat before, and he manages to resurrect himself, and he did again this time. With the uprising that started in December of 87, in a sense that was a real threat for Arafat, because now there was a leadership, an underground leadership in the West Bank, and that was certainly a threat to him. I think he probably was not prepared for all of this to happen, and in a way, in a sense, probably raced to catch up to try to exert the PLO's leadership and his leadership in that situation. He had every right to be concerned, because there are within the West Bank, again, different factions which could certainly have started squabbling with each other and have lessened the effect of the Intifada. So he was right in being as concerned as he was to try to control that uprising. And I think certainly until now he has been in control, though that's a question that you can always answer, or you can always ask the question at least. Regardless of what the Israelis say, most people in the West Bank and in Gaza recognize the PLO as their sole and legitimate representative, and they have a very high regard for Yasser Arafat. I don't know what may happen when the time comes, and I hope it comes soon, for the Palestinians to sit down and start talking with the Israelis. It will be interesting to see if Arafat is in that delegation. I sometimes think that he won't be, simply because of the tremendous amount of bloody historical baggage he brings to those negotiations. Though it's interesting to note that if you want to look at a person who was certainly more responsible for Israeli deaths than anything that Arafat could claim, that would be, well, it would be Anwar Sadat, because Anwar Sadat was the person, of course, who launched the Yom Kippur War against Israel that it almost lost. I don't have the exact number of casualties. I don't know exactly how many Israelis were killed, but certainly far, far, far more Israelis lost their life in the Yom Kippur War than ever lost their life in scattered, you know, so terrorist attacks from the PLO. And yet, when Sadat came to Jerusalem overnight, he was one of the biggest heroes that that Israel had ever known. So I don't know if Arafat will be there, but it's an interesting thing to think about. There's an interesting story that in a sense I think demonstrates the problem that Arafat has had with balancing some of the factions within the PLO, certainly in relationship to the uprising. There is a fellow by the name of Bassam Abu Sharif, who is quite an interesting fellow, and he is, I guess you would call him within the PLO structure, something like their press secretary. So you have a feeling that when Abu Sharif makes a statement, that you probably can say that Arafat has cleared this with Arafat beat ahead of time. And last June 23, 1988, Abu Sharif made this statement, which I think is quite amazing. And I was also quite amazed at the little press coverage it got in the United States. But this is what Abu Sharif said well over a year ago. He said, "Everything that has been said about the Middle East conflict has focused on the differences between Palestinians and Israelis and ignored the points on which they are in almost total agreement. These points are easy to overlook, hidden as they are under a 70-year accumulation of mutual hostility and suspicion, but they exist nevertheless, and in them lies the hope that the peace that has eluded this region for so long is finally within reach. Peel off the layers of fear and mistrust that successive Israeli leaders have piled on the substantive issues, and you will find that the Palestinians and the Israelis are in general agreement on the ends and the means. Israel's objectives are lasting peace and security. Lasting peace and security are also the objectives of the Palestinian people. No one can understand the Jewish people's centuries of suffering more than the Palestinians. We know what it means to be stateless and the object of the fear and prejudice of the nations. Thanks to the various Israeli and other governments that have had the power to determine the course of our people's lives, we know what it feels like when human beings are considered somewhat less human than others and denied the basic rights that people around the globe take for granted. We feel that no people, neither the Jewish people nor the Palestinian people, deserves the abuse and disenfranchisement and homelessness that homelessness inevitably entails. We believe that all peoples, the Jews and the Palestinians included, have the right to run their own affairs, expecting from their neighbors not only non-belligerence, but the kind of political and economic cooperation without which no state can be truly secure, no matter how massive its war machine, and without which no nation can truly prosper, no matter how generous its friends at distant lands may be." It goes on and on. It is without a doubt one of the most moderate statements that certainly ever came from the PLO. So we never saw anything like this in the past. It was very interesting to see what happened. This statement came out, and about 3 days later, another member of the PLO totally rejected it in the newspapers. And after I read that, I became very angry again. Here is the PLO doing what they've done so many times in the past. They say something moderate, and then some of the more rejectionist group of the organization comes out and say, no, 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 we reject this. This is, doesn't represent us. And it gives certainly the Israelis and other critics of Palestinian liberation movement ammunition to say, look, you can't trust these people because they always talk out of the side of their mouth, blah, 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 blah. But then it was very interesting to see what happened. After the statement had been made, and after this other person had said, rejected it, said it didn't represent PLO thinking, obviously the word came from the Palestinians who were who were leading the uprising in the West Bank, and those people said, no, this is exactly what we want said. We have lived under Israeli occupation for 20 years. We understand what this is like. These rejectionists, the people who are not living under occupation, they can say, well, you know, we should fight the Israelis militarily, et cetera, et cetera. But we know what it's like. We can't beat them. We can't beat them militarily. We know that. So in a sense, Arafat then said, this statement is what the PLO stands for. And he had the ability, or he had the power to say that, because in a sense his power structure had moved from those factions of the PLO that he always had to juggle to the people who were literally fighting in the streets in the West Bank. And for him, that was an incredibly liberating experience, and it has allowed him, I am sure, to be able to make the statements that he made in Geneva. So in that sense, the uprising was really very important for him as a leader, because again, he was freed from this balancing act and could therefore present himself as the leader of the uprising in the West Bank. Do we have any, let's stop here before we go on any further. Anybody got any questions about what I've said so far? Has it made any sense?
Are you going to speak to the recent election which was dominated by the conservatives in Israel?
Right. I'm going to get to that because that's very important in just what happened last week, okay? Well, I think we should look at where all the sides are now politically, kind of at the status quo right now. The Palestinians, I believe, are waiting. They feel that they have time on their side. They have made tremendous gains in the last year and a half since the uprising began. The Israelis have been asking them to call off the violence, call off the uprising, but they won't do it. And they won't do it simply because it is the only thing that has gotten them any closer to what they believe their national self-determination. So they are not going to call it off. Israel says that the violence must cease before negotiations can begin. The Palestinians are rejecting that. The spirit of the Palestinians now is quite amazing. They are certainly more organized than they have ever been as a people in the past. Before, they tended to be a community that was shot through with factionalism, and there were family rivalries and all the rest of this. They are much more united now. It may be hard to believe, but a lot of Palestinians are going around about their life in the West Bank as though the Palestinian state already exists. As much as Israel would like its people to believe that its army is in control in the West Bank, the fact is that there are simply not enough Israeli soldiers, there are not enough Israeli men to put in uniform to control the West Bank the way that that the Israelis would like it controlled. When I was there 2 months ago, I was with one of the ELCA missionaries, and we were driving in the West Bank and going to the town of Bir Zeit, where one of the major Palestinian universities is located. And Bir Zeit is a kind of place that you approach from below. It's up on a hill. And when we came around the last corner, I saw Palestinian flags flying from every place, from the top of the church, from the top of the mosque, from the top of the flagpoles, from the top of the trees, from the electric wires. We drove into town, there was graffiti on the walls everywhere. And the man that I was with said, well, it seems as though he had been there the night before, and he said, the Israeli army, I saw the army, but it doesn't look like they've gotten here, because if they'd gotten here, they would have taken all the flags down and they would have had the people come out and whitewash the graffiti off the walls. So he thought that the army hadn't gotten there. When we got into town, we asked a few of the people, and they said, oh, no, the army got here. There was a helicopter. They threw down some tear gas. But, yeah, we took down a few flags. They made us take whitewash a little graffiti. But then they left town, and everything just went up again. So in a way, it's just business as usual. The army comes in every 3 or 4 days on a patrol. They take down the flags. They wash off the graffiti or paint over the graffiti, and then after they're out of town, the flags go up and life goes on as usual. There's one problem that I've seen in the Palestinian community, and that is what I fear to be a spirit that's come as a result of this uprising that has tended to make them a little irrational, tended to make them believe that perhaps they have a little more power than they really do. The fact is that this, the Palestinians are going to get their self-determination through negotiated means. They're not going to get it through force. They can't. If the Israelis would decide to put down the uprising in the West Bank, they could do it. There would be thousands of casualties, and Israel probably would not want to risk the tremendous international fallout that would come out from, you know, moving the tanks in and mowing people down, like we saw in China. But the fact is that's a possibility, and I think the Palestinians have maybe, in a sense, forgotten that. As brutal as the Israelis have been in terms of their beatings and other things, they certainly could have been more brutal. And they have people in Israel now simply saying, this uprising should be put down. It should be put down by force. Of course, those people don't understand that in order to have it put down, I don't know how many thousands of casualties the Palestinians would have to take, and it would be extremely detrimental for Israel in its public relations image in the world. Okay, where is the United States? The U.S. right now is in a very interesting position. As you know, it's after Arafat's speech, the U.S. State Department started talks in Tunis with representatives from the PLO, and just last week I heard that those talks have now expanded to include another interesting person, Salah Khalaf, who is another very close associate of Yasser Arafat. So it seems to me that right now the United States position is really closer to that of the Palestinians than it is of the Israelis.
Don't you think the uprisings have really helped to bring that about, though? Without the uprisings, I don't think
it wouldn't have happened.
Well, where's all the money go to, though? It still goes to Israel, doesn't it?
Well, that's something that, you know, that we have to talk about.
Lots
certainly
of money.
If Israel is not seen to be more forthcoming in these negotiations, it would seem to me that U.S. taxpayers would have some difficulty in seeing between $3 and $4 billion of taxpayers' money going to support the Israeli government, which just last week did nothing more than turn around and slap George Bush and James Baker in the face. What the Americans have been saying to both the Israelis and the Palestinians is that this issue has to be settled diplomatically. It is not a military issue. It should not be settled in a military fashion. In fact, some of the leading generals in the Israeli army, retired generals in the Israeli army, have been saying the same thing. The chief of staff, the current chief of staff of the Israeli army, a man by the name of General Dan Shamron, said 2 or 3 months ago that this is a political issue. It isn't a military issue. We can't settle this militarily. But then you run into this whole issue of the current government in Israel, which is totally really incapable of moving, of pressing this diplomatic process forward. The United States said to Israel that they had to be more forthcoming. They could not simply say, after Arafat had gotten up in Geneva and said these things, and then, of course, the Israelis simply said, well, there's nothing new and you can't trust him and it doesn't mean anything. And at that point, the U.S. government said, now, wait a minute, it does mean something. And you have to take what Arafat has said very seriously. And so the Israelis were scrambling around trying to come up with some kind of a plan that would appease the Americans, who for the first time are really putting political pressure on Israel. James Baker, the Secretary of State, went to address the APAC, the American-Israel Political Public Affairs Committee, which is the strongest pro-Israel lobby in the United States. And when he addressed them a month ago, he was very, nobody had ever heard a speech like this before. What he essentially said was Israel is going to have to give up its idea of a greater Israel, meaning it's going to have to give up its idea of annexing the West Bank, that if there's going to be peace, there has to be territorial compromise. So that sent the Israelis scrambling, because Shamir was supposed to come to the United States then 3 or 4 weeks later, and Baker had made it very clear to him that he would have to come with some plan. So he comes with a plan for elections. And in a way, this is very calculating on the part of the Israelis, because they know Americans like the sound of elections. It sounds very, sounds very democratic, et cetera, et cetera. Get the Palestinians into an election so we can have some representatives who will sit down and discuss the situation with the Israelis. Well, Shamir got himself into a real big problem, and the enormity of that problem has just shown itself in the last 3 or 4 days. Shamir put forth a program or a plan for elections for limited autonomy in the West Bank. Well, let's talk a little bit about first his Likud party. The Likud party is, as I said up here, the conservatives. They are the nationalists. There are a number of parties. The thing you have to understand about Israeli politics is there are more parties than you can shake a stick at. We have only 2 parties. I think there are at least 25 parties in Israel. And the liberals have kind of come together in the Labor coalition. The conservatives have come together in the Likud coalition. But in the Likud coalition are the right, very right-wing nationalist parties who have simply said there will be no compromise. We will never give back 1 inch of the West Bank. That is not negotiable. There are many Israelis who certainly, according to the polls, a majority of Israelis who would be able to make territorial compromises for a real and lasting peace. That doesn't mean they give up all the West Bank, because they've got 80,000 people living over there on settlements that have been built since 1967. But there are people who would be willing to make that compromise. And Shamir is now in big trouble, because the far right-wing parties in his Likud coalition have now attached 4 kind of rules to this election process. Number one, this was just in the paper 2 days ago. Number one, there will be elections, fine, but Israel will continue to build settlements in the West Bank. Number two, Israel will make no territorial compromises. There will not be 1 inch of land given up, and there will never ever be a possibility of a Palestinian state. Number three, all of the violence in the West Bank must end before the elections began. And number four, all the residents of East Jerusalem is annexed now to Israel, but it contains some of the major leaders of the Palestinian community, that those people will not be able to vote in the elections. Now, this is very serious, because this is the slap in the face of the United States, without a doubt, because the United States disagrees with each of these. Disagrees with the settlements, disagrees with the compromise. I mean, One of the things the Israelis always used to say about the Palestinians that they had to accept UN Resolution 242 and 338. Well, the basis of those resolutions are that there will be territorial compromise. Israel will have to give back some of the land in the West Bank for peace. And now we see the Israelis not accepting that at all. They've said, why don't the Palestinians accept it? Arafat gets up at the UN and accepts it, but now the Israelis will not do it. So in a sense, Shamir is digging himself into a really very serious situation, because in order for his coalition to hold together, he has to go along with these four new rules. And if he would not go along with them, his government would fall. This is a parliamentary type of government. It's made by coalition, and if one group pulls out, if they have a certain number, then the government is no longer represents the majority of the people, and therefore another election has to be called. Again, this is very serious business, and it's going to be interesting to see what the United States does. The newspaper said that there was a very low-key response given from the U.S. government, but I think the reason that it was such a low-key response is that the U.S. government is hoping that this will happen, that this government will fall, and that elections will take place then in Israel, and a government will be elected that will be more forthcoming on this election issue. What we have now in Israel is this crazy government called the Government of National Unity. The last elections were so close in Israel that both parties, the Likud and Labor, had to come together in order to form a coalition. It's as if the Republicans and Democrats were running against each other, and the election was so close that both the Republicans and Democrats had to share power. And George Bush would be president for 4 years, and Dukakis would have been foreign minister for 4 years, and then after 4 years they would have switched. The labor people now, who are also in this national unity government, I think within the next week will probably pull out of it. I think these four rules that have been added to the election proposal will not be able to go along with. And if they pull out and some of the other parties pull out, then there'll have to be a new election. And I hope there will be, because I think, frankly, that this will be Israel's last chance to really get a diplomatic process going. The United States, I think, in this case, is doing exactly the right thing. I think Baker's speech was excellent. I never thought I would hear an American politician, certainly a Secretary of State, make that kind of speech. It was quite good to see. And the United States has had so many catastrophes when it has involved itself in a very big way in Middle East politics. Remember what happened in Lebanon? That was a real debacle. I think the U.S. government has learned that its role should be one of encouraging both sides to make the compromises necessary, to do everything necessary to bring the two parties together, but not by any means to come into the situation with a U.S. proposal for peace. That's one thing Baker is very, he's very intelligent, he's very smart not to do that, because when that happens, then both sides can just kind of shoot it out of the water. They don't have to take any responsibility. I think Baker and the U.S. government believes that the peace has to be made between the Israelis and Palestinians, and they have to want the peace bad enough. Because if it's a peace that is imposed from outside, it will probably not be lasting. Both of these people have got to want it, and they've got to want it bad enough. In this case, I think the government is saying the Israelis have got to want it bad enough to get rid of this government and to elect a government that will be willing to deal realistically with the Palestinians. And if they're willing to do that, fine. If they're not willing to do it, then let them put up with the uprising. Let them let the pot, in a sense, let the pot boil a little longer, because the U.S. is not going to come in the middle of this and have make some big plan that can then just be rejected by both sides. Well, that what do I hope would happen? I hope that the government falls. I hope there is a new government elected in Israel that more realistically reflects the desires of the people. I think the desires of, certainly there are right-wingers who want to get rid of all the Palestinians and want to never give back any of the West Bank, but I think still the majority of Israelis want to sit down and talk with the PLO. If that can happen, if there can be a new government in Israel, then it's time for the Palestinians to come in. And there will be some kind of agreement about elections. I would assume that the Israeli army would withdraw out of some areas. There would be international observers who would be sure that these elections are honest and are run correctly. After the elections, you would have a group, finally, of Palestinians leadership elected by the people who would then sit down and start talking to the Israelis. Probably will be a difficult spot in the road when these people are elected. They're certainly going to be PLO representatives. They're not going to be anything other than that. The Israelis have this strange idea that they can get another, what they call an alternative leadership in the West Bank, but that's impossible because the PLO still represents all the Palestinians. I hope by that time they'll be wise enough to realize that at last there's a group that they can sit down and talk to, and then they talk about the hard business. That is a framework for a peaceful settlement. One of the things the Palestinians have said, and they're starting to get more and more reasonable about this, Arafat said it again last week, Palestinians are not expecting a state tomorrow. They don't want a state tomorrow. They shouldn't have a state tomorrow, because they have no, they've had no time to put together any kind of institutions, any kind of governmental structures. They need time to put those things in place so that perhaps 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line, we may see an independent Palestinian state. It's important that they have that time to get their own house in order, but it's also important that the Israelis have that time to get accustomed to living with Palestinians as their neighbors in a different kind of situation other than occupation. The Israelis are still frightened to death of the Palestinians. Whether that's a rational or irrational fear, who can say? But both of these peoples need time. There's been so much bloody history and so many bad things that have happened in the past that both Palestinians need time to get themselves organized, to rule themselves, and the Israelis need time to get to know the Palestinians. To certainly during this period of 8 to 10 years, there would be contact between the two communities, basically in economics. Israel and Palestinians need each other. One thing I've always said when I think of them, of these two communities, I think of two octopi, whatever you want to call them, who have embraced each other. And trying to get these tentacles undone is impossible because the Palestinians have come to appreciate a great deal of Israeli life. They certainly like the fact that there's a Supreme Court. They like elections. They like a lot of the democratic institutions that they see within Israel. And the Israelis and the Palestinians, if they could cooperate together, my goodness, what it would mean in terms of agriculture, in terms of industrial development. The Palestinians are the most well-educated Arab group in the Middle East. They are incredibly bright and incredibly capable people. And if the Israelis and Palestinians ever got together, my goodness, the rest of the Middle East would just have to kind of stand back and watch, because you would have within one small area an Arab population, Jewish population, who are extremely well-educated and capable. And what these two people could do together is amazing. It's really amazing. And I only hope that this right wing, these right wing crazy people do not have the day, because believe me, if something happens where this election plan doesn't happen, or if there's even a more conservative government elected in Israel, then I think we're going to be in real trouble. Because that's going to push all of the moderate people into the extremes on both sides, and then things are only going to get worse and worse. I don't think we've even begun to imagine how bad they could get.
Do you think what is the possibility of, if things don't get better, of Palestinians using nuclear weapons? Is there any fear, any reality?
Palestinians won't use nuclear weapons because they don't have any, but the Israelis certainly do. And if the Israelis would find themselves in a position where they were pushed in a corner and felt that their lives were in danger, really in danger, I'm sure they would not hesitate to use nuclear weapons. And they have them. They say they don't, but everybody knows that they do.
Well, the whole argument is over real estate. That would deny the use of a bunch of real estate, wouldn't it?
Right, it would, but people get pushed to the wall, and they, you know, the Jews will never, after the Holocaust, if it's a matter of national survival, I think that we have to be realistic and say that they probably would use nuclear weapons. But of course, everything would be wiped out. And we're talking about such a small area, such a terribly small area, that it doesn't make any sense, of course. The thing that is most, I talked about this thing being a tragedy the other day. The thing that is almost diabolical about it is that when the Jews decided to come back to the place where they felt they had to make their home, the geography of the area simply made it necessary that they could only get the security that they wanted and that they needed through peaceful relationships with their neighbors. The kind of security that Israel wants cannot come from military hardware, simply because the area is so small and because of the sophisticated weapons that everybody has these days. So in a sense, it is almost diabolical that this people who yearn for security more than anything else and a place to be a haven would come to an area where simply the geography meant that they could only get that kind of security in having peace with their neighbors and not being in a continual state of war. They'll never get the kind of security they want that way.
What can you say about the influence of the non-Zionist Jews in the United States? We read about the meeting with Arafat in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It would appear from the press that there seems to be more non-Zionist American Jews speaking out.
Yeah. Well, those Jews would call themselves Zionists, but they certainly is Zionist in the sense that they identify themselves with the State of Israel and they want the State of Israel to exist. But yes, the thing that is amazing to see is that the kind of the unofficial agenda seemed, at least in the spring, to be running much faster than the official agenda. I was at a meeting in Washington, D.C. about 2 months ago where Rita Hauser, the woman who is the lawyer, she's an American Jewish woman, she's a lawyer, she works in the Department of State, she had gone to Stockholm to meet Arafat face to face simply because she felt, and a number of liberal Jews in the United States felt, that they could not simply go along with the official line from Israel, which was that Arafat had said nothing new and that whatever he said should not be trusted, et cetera, et cetera. So she and about three other rather well-known figures from the American Jewish community went to meet Arafat in Stockholm. The meeting was set up by, I think, the Swedish ambassador to the United States. And when I heard her speak, she said simply that there is nothing in this conflict that cannot be settled by some creative diplomacy. And what we've got to do is get both sides to that point where we can start dealing with it diplomatically. But in order to do that, you've got to have an official delegation for Palestinians. You've got to have somebody to represent the Palestinians who will be democratically elected by them. And here's the block right now, because the Palestinians will not certainly agree to the elections that are outlined by Shamir. They say, look, we don't need a state right now, but we must have a guarantee before we start this diplomatic process that there's a willingness to make territorial compromise. At this meeting, it was very interesting. The person who articulated that the best was a Jewish man by the name of Arthur Hertzberg. And he said to this audience, look, folks, you can understand the Palestinians' position. If you go to a train station to get on a train, you want to know where that train is going. You just don't kind of wander around and get on any train. If you want to go to Chicago, you get on the train that's going to Chicago. And that's all the Palestinians are really asking at this point. They're not saying, we got to have a state tomorrow. Arafat in a paper 2 days ago, in a letter that was sent to George Bush by Mubarak, the president of Egypt, said, we don't need a state right now. We don't need an international conference right now. Maybe we want a confederation with Jordan. Maybe we want a confederation even with Israel. But we just have to know that there is a possibility for self-determination down the way. And then when Shamir says, no compromise, build more settlements on the West Bank, why should the Palestinians get involved? Yes?
How many Palestinians are there, ballpark number? And then how many Israelis are there?
Oh, that's a real interesting question, because it brings up the whole issue of the demographic problem.
And do we send money to the Palestinians?
I ask first.
Okay, all right. There are in Gaza 650,000 Palestinians. In the West Bank, about all Palestinians together, West Bank and Gaza, about 2 million. In Israel, Israelis, about 3.5 million. But then, of course, there are about 650,000 Palestinians or Arab citizens of Israel living there as well. And then in the diaspora, I think all told, I've heard a number somewhere around 5 million Palestinians altogether.
And so there are more, I'm sorry.
6 million Israelis?
No, in Israel about 3.5 million.
Okay. Yeah. So there are more Palestinians than there are Israelis?
Well, certainly not more Palestinians living in that area now. There are about 2 million Palestinians living in the United States, in other Arab countries, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. When you talk about geographics, what's the size in question that Palestine would be interested in?
Just simply that area that Israel took during 67. Oh, you're talking about a land area not more than 180 miles long and at the narrow points 60, 70 miles wide. It's not very big, but it would be with Gaza. It would be with the Gaza Strip. That's what they say that the state would be. I don't know. I think this confederation idea with Jordan is the most realistic one to think about right now. And if King Hussein, of course, is not a Palestinian, he's a Bedouin, and he rules a country where the population is already a majority of Palestinians. I think the Palestinian state is going to need a confederation with another country just simply to get things going, just get things off the ground. There's nothing in the West Bank, really. I mean, there's agriculture. That's it. There's some schools. But in terms of any kind of infrastructure and institutions, they don't exist. The Jews, of course, when they were trying to struggle to realize their national dream of a Jewish state, they were living under the British occupation, and they had 30 or 40 years to get schools set up, to have a government set up, so when the British pulled out the next day, everything just went, it was there, it was ready to go. Palestinians don't have that, so that's why they need the time. That's why they need the time. Yeah.
In the last several years, I've met many Israelis who have immigrated to the United States, mm-hmm. citing reasons such as high inflation,
right,
overcrowding, and also the current regressive trend in their government.
Right.
Is that much of a force in Israel?
Well, I think if things get worse, I think if the conservatives and the right-wing nationalists led by the likes of Ariel Sharon, if the government should go more in that way, I think you would find a tremendous number of Israelis leaving. I have a very close family. I consider them my second parents, who live on a kibbutz in Israel. And here's a woman who left Kiel, Germany in the summer of 1939. She got out of Germany just in time before the Second World War started. Her husband immigrated from Canada. And she has said to me simply, if Ariel Sharon should ever become prime minister of this country, I'm leaving. Right? That's an incredible thought, because this woman came there when there was nothing, and that's the home that she knows, but she would not live in Israel with a government like that, and there are a lot of people, I'm sure, who wouldn't. It's a real problem. I think right now, I've said it before, but I think the Israeli people are really facing a crossroads. If, in fact, the Labor government does pull out now and the government falls, then there will be elections. And if they can wrest the power away from the right-wing crazy people, the right-wing nationalists, and get down to business about talking with the Palestinians, I think there's going to be a chance. If they don't, then they're also running a real big risk in the long run in terms of support from the United States. I mean, how is the U.S. has talked to Israel very openly and very clearly at the highest levels now, and to simply reject, or as I said, slap Bush and Baker in the face, the Israelis are going to have to learn that there's a price to be paid for that. You know, and the price is $3 to $4 billion
a
year.
They'll see that happen.
Yeah.
Because we all know the power that the Jewish community has in the United States.
Yeah, but the Jewish community in the United States is, most of them, certainly there are some right-wing nationalists among them, but most of my Jewish friends are appalled. I mean, what will they have in common with this Jewish state? What possibly will they have in common? The thing they had in common with it before is that it was a democracy, it was this, it was that. If all that goes, and it may go.
Well, I wouldn't call it a democracy the way they gobbled up land in 1967. I mean, you can say it was.
Well, we're talking about democratic institutions.
Sure.
We're talking about a Supreme Court. We're talking about a
foreign policy.